Mythisches Irland, Teil 2 unseres Interviews mit Autor Anthony Murphy. Too late. Immer etwas zu spät. So wie das weiße Kaninchen bei Alice im Wunderland. Hallo, ich bin Chris und zusammen mit meiner Frau Fee bringen wir euch unseren Podcast Erlebnis Irland. Diesmal sind wir gleich in zweierlei Hinsicht zu spät. Erstens mal, weil wir, wie wir euch ja schon erzählt haben, zu spät dran waren zum Interview in Dorf mit unserem Interviewpartner Anthony Murphy. Aber dieses Mal sind wir gleich auch noch aus dem zweiten Grund zu spät, was die Erscheinung dieses Podcasts angeht, weil es sind gerade Sommerferien und wir sind mit unseren Kids im Urlaub. Deshalb haben wir es leider nicht geschafft, die letzte Episode rechtzeitig fertig zu bekommen. Aber jetzt mit einer Woche Verspätung hier unser zweiter Teil von unserem Interview Mystisches Irland mit Anthony Murphy. Anthony Murphy ist ein bekannter Autor, der sich auf irische Geschichte spezialisiert hat. Er hat gleich mehrere Bücher über die kulturellen und politischen und religiösen Aspekte Irlands geschrieben. Er polarisiert und wird trotzdem aber von Kritikern wie auch von Lesern geschätzt. Er verfügt über ein internationales Publikum, das bis nach Australien reicht. Murphy verbindet in seinen Werken historische Fakten mit persönlichen Erzählungen und schafft so ein lebendiges Bild von einem Land, das oft missverstanden wird und oft stereotyp dargestellt wird. Er zeigt Irland, wie es trotz vieler Herausforderungen und Konflikten seinen eigenen Weg in der Welt gefunden hat und, was auch gut zu unserem Podcast passt, es zu einem einzigartigen und faszinierenden Ort macht. Viel Spaß beim Interview mit Anthony Murphy.
This is where the stone now, where we see the suns or just the carvings?
No, they're very difficult to see right now. And in fact, even sometimes when the sun is shining, if it's not shining at the correct angle, they're very difficult to see. But in the late hours of the morning, coming up towards midday, when the sun is almost south, but is at a shallow angle, these symbols are illuminated brilliantly. But they do look like depictions of a solar eclipse where the moon is covering the sun, but you have the solar prominences, the flares visible around. Now, that's one possible explanation. Some people have said they look like flowers. Maybe they're just ordinary depictions of the sun. Maybe they're not anything to do with eclipses. And of course, the difficulty for us is we will never know. Because the artist who created those crouched here more than 5 millennia ago, and we can't ask him or her what the meaning is. Mm-hmm. Now, the fact that a lot of the artwork at Bruna Bonia is abstract is interesting in relation to the discussion we were just having about hierarchical society. Mm-hmm. Because if you have people in control and they have sacred information, for instance, the ability to predict eclipses. Eclipses happen in patterns, sequences. Lunar eclipses in particular, solar eclipses are much more difficult because they can only be seen along a narrow strip of the Earth. But somebody with that information could use that information to gain control of the populace, you know. And I'm just curious about the fact that Bressel has ultimate control in that during a cattle famine. Now remember, the people of the Neolithic, the New Stone Age, they were the ones who brought farming to Ireland. Before the Neolithic, there's no cattle or horses, and there's no crop husbandry, there's no sheep. They bring all that. So if you've got a myth that mentions a shortage of cattle, that undoubtedly means there's some major crisis going on. Because why would cattle die? Maybe a cattle disease, fair enough. But more likely, there's a problem in relation to feeding them. You know, that the grass isn't growing. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a time of great challenge. And what does he do in the middle of this time of great challenge? He brings them in and orders them to build him a big monument, you know.
Maybe in order to help against the famine, to make him more powerful, in order to be closer to the gods.
It is a curious thing that in the mythology, so I was mentioning earlier about the Tuatha Dé Danann, mm-hmm. the gods eventually being defeated by the Milesians. It's a curious thing that it is said that after the Dé Danann had gone into their she mounds and the Milesians had taken control of the surface land, the Tuatha Dé Danann were still creating an influence on the crops and would cause the crops to fail, which led to the Milesians having to make offerings to try to propitiate, the situation. So that's nearly incorporated into the myths. And it almost leaves you wondering if the fact that these are the biggest, that maybe at the time they were being built, there was a crisis. And enter the modern science called dendrochronology, the study of tree rings. Mm-hmm. And a team of scientists from Belfast, based on this island, have put together a record of Irish climate that goes right back to about 7,000. Is it 7,000 years ago or 7,000 BC? I'm never sure. Mm-hmm. And they have identified six major climate events. Events during which the tree rings were very close together, in which there was no growth happening. Mm-hmm. The last of those was in 540 AD, or centred around 540 AD, which coincides with, for instance, the Justinian Plague, which eventually wipes out about a quarter to a third of the European population. Also coincides with references in the Irish annals to a failure of bread. Mm-hmm. And again, when you see failure of bread, what does that mean in plain English? Failure of the crop. Mm-hmm. That is needed to make bread. So the first of those six events is 3195 BC. 3195 BC. And when are we told Newgrange was built? 3200 BC. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not a precise date, because carbon dating always comes with a plus or minus 50 or 100 years. Mm-hmm. So it's not a precise date. So it would seem that there was a very... Well, it's not that it would seem. There very definitely was a major event centred on 3195 BC, in which there was no growth happening on the trees. I wonder whether the myth retains part of that information. There was a cattle famine, and there was only one bull and seven cows left on the whole island. Mm-hmm. And the king brought all the men to build him this monument. And exactly as you say, maybe they were trying to pray to the gods to avert a complete tragedy.
Yeah, this is happening also if you look at the Crusades, where they have the saints carried around different cities in order to make them happy again. And if they win, then they get a bigger house, and if they lose, they are degraded.
Wow. So yeah. same sort of thing.
Yeah,
and as a matter of interest, the last of the six events is 540 AD. It's about a century after, a little bit more than a century after, the supposed arrival of Christianity into Ireland, when St. Patrick arrived. Mm-hmm. And he's supposed to have sailed up the Boyne River, past the monuments, and gone up to the Hill of Slane and lit the Paschal fire there on the Easter Vigil, the Easter Saturday evening, in 433 AD. Mm-hmm. Now, from 433, from the 400s into the 500s, when we look at the establishment of churches around Ireland, it follows a very shallow increase. There's just a church here and a church there. And after 540, it rockets skyward. The number of churches being built in Ireland proliferates. And I just wonder, is it, and I suggested this to Mike Bailey, who's the team who led that whole dendrochronology project, are we seeing the same thing as what's suggested here? Were they building more churches to pray to God to please end our suffering, send the sun back? Because they reckon the 540 event was the result of multiple volcano eruptions around the planet that had basically made mm-hmm. the atmosphere full of dust and cloaked the sun.
You have lots of things in history. if you take at the past, for example, where people promise to build little churches or chapels, and then after the epidemic is gone, everyone builds something. So it may happen like that, because yeah. people work like that. They try to get in contact with God or the saints or whatever you call them. And then if it works out, then they have to get into the promise and build something yeah. like that. So yeah. The same with the pyramids too. You have the big pyramids at certain times where humanity struggles, and so this may also be their way to go to yeah. please the gods.
And it may not have been seen as an act of slavery. Mm-hmm. It may have been seen as something that was absolutely necessary, and so that everybody who took part did so with an element of zeal and enthusiasm, knowing that this is very important for the future mm-hmm. of our survival, you know. Mm-hmm. But I do find it remarkable. I'm increasingly mm-hmm. leaning towards the belief that the mythology contains truth.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you also wrote that the church changed the names so that the landscape was called differently after the church came yeah. into the region.
And the best example of that is Newgrange. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. the three mounds are Knowth, Dowth and Newgrange. Knowth is from Knogoba or Knokboi. So the Dinchanicus gives two alternatives as to how it got its name. In the case of Dowth, from Dua, darkness. But Newgrange is a new name. And when I say new, I mean about 8 centuries. Very modern in terms of the timelines we're talking about. Newgrange is a name that was given to that a monument and that area by the arrival of the Cistercian order from France in the 12th century. In 1142, just a few kilometres north of Brunabonia, they established Mellifont Abbey, which was the first and later the largest Cistercian abbey in Ireland. Mm-hmm. They were granted huge tracts of land by the local king, whose name was Donacha O'Carroll. And, of course, as with all these things, church and politics are never too far apart. This is one of the reasons that Christian monks ended up writing down what was essentially pagan mythology, because they needed the kings on their side to grant them the lands and to allow them to do what they did. But they established granges. Mm-hmm. I'm told, I don't know much French, grange, you know, a farm. And so they left those place names. There are 4 townlands in this immediate area that have the Grange in them. Newgrange, over the way here we have Sheepgrange, Little Grange, just where that field is there beyond the hedge. Mm-hmm. And on that side of the river, that hill there is called Rough Grange, which is actually Rough from Rua, from Red. The Red Mountain is what it's called. Newgrange's original name is Sheedin Broga, which would be pronounced in modern Irish Sheon Vru. Again, that word she, which we have no adequate translation for in the English language. You'll see many of the 20th and 19th century writers suggesting it means a fairy mound. But in fact, the best translation, I believe, is the one that says otherworld mound. Mm-hmm. In other words, portal. Mm-hmm. This is a liminal place that demarks a very, very special sacred place where you can go to access other worlds. And in the case of the Dedannans, you don't just go there, but you can come back again. And when they come back out, they can choose whether they can be seen by humans or not. They have a cloak, like the Harry Potter cloak in the movie, you know, a cloak of invisibility that they can put over themselves so they're completely unseen by humans. And the folk belief of recent centuries has been that they can come back, and that in fact they will come back at a time, sometimes it's called the end of the world or some great cataclysm, some great battle. They will come thronging out of the Sidhe in this great battle, and they will be victorious, and they will restore glory to Ireland.
Okay, so if you look at that way, well, people go back to nature at the moment, so maybe they're glorious that way.
Yeah.
So if people get more into nature, try to think about what happens to Earth and want to give things back, get more environmental friendly, you say?
Yeah. Well, there's a curious prophecy at the end of the Battle of Moytura, which is a very famous Irish story in which the Tuatha Dé Danann defeat their dark, evil counterparts, the Fomorians. And it's called the Morrigu's prophecy, the Morrigan's prophecy. And it's funny, it's curious because it contains two separate poems or songs, one of which predicts a time of abundance and the glory has returned to the land, but the other depicting a time in the future when things would be very evil and men and women would do terrible things to each other and, you know, and we would cease to care for the earth and all that stuff. So it is interesting in that regard. However, it comes with a little hint of caution in that nobody should look at the Neolithic and think that this is a time when people lived with nature. Yes, we don't see the large-scale cities and agriculture that we see today, but we do see the beginning of fencing off fields and saying, this is mine, you know? And we do see the beginning of monoculture in the Neolithic. I mean, that is where really modern civilization...
Beren is one place where you can see that there was a lot of damage done at that time too.
Yeah, so they weren't necessarily entirely at one with nature in the way that some people think, perhaps naively. However, I suppose the other side of looking at that is, if you go back to Neolithic Ireland, a great part of this island is covered in forest, in bogs, and land that wasn't drained. The drainage of Irish farmland really only took place effectively in the last couple of centuries. So you've got an island which is very difficult to get into the interior of in the Neolithic because, as I say, bogs, dense forest, overgrowth. There's no roads and there's no transport other than cattle or horse. So in fact, the river Boyne offers the access for Brú na Bóinne, which is why they think, one of the reasons that they think it's so important to the monuments, because you come in from the sea and you build the monuments and you can actually bring materials from the sea up the river because it's tidal, you know. But this notion that they were in touch with nature, I think that they certainly were closer to the stars and the sky and they kept a very careful watch on the movements of the sun, the movements of the moon, the way the patterns of what we call the constellations change from season to season. I think they were very, very acutely aware of all of that and absolutely, without doubt, knew about the connection between the moon and the tide, because the movement of these stones, well, not specifically these ones, but the ones at Newgrange, were all brought from Clogherhead on the coast, all brought by boat up the river. And that has to have occurred in conjunction with the tides. So I think they knew that connection all along. And in fact, how did they come here in the first place? I mean, the people of the Neolithic. Ireland was always an island, even during the Ice Age. Ireland, there hasn't been a land bridge between Ireland and Britain for at least 25,000 years, apparently. So the arrival of the people and the cattle around 6,000 years ago has to have taken place across the sea.
You say they brought lots of material here. We know from Newgrange that they brought quartz, white quartz. I don't see any here, but was there quartz found here too?
There are small amounts of it that can be seen in various places on the western side of the cairn. It is likely that quartz was found at Nowth as well. And we know that the cairns at Loch Crew, which is also in County Meath, but is about maybe 30 or 40 kilometres from where we are now, they were known as the White Cairns, Cairn Bon, some of them. And they were covered in white quartz until even into the 20th century. But that white quartz was taken away by people to be broken up to be used to decorate graves, which is really, when you think about it, stupendously ironic. Because the thought is that the quartz was a decorative stone to decorate the tombs. And people in later centuries took away that stone to decorate their own family graves. Continuing, it seems, something of a tradition going back 5,000 years. Now, as to whether that was a continuous tradition, we couldn't say. But the thing about Dowth is, despite the damage that was caused in the 1840s, a significant portion of the cairn on this side is basically untouched. So there are secrets to be revealed in the future by archaeologists, And I have no doubt that when they excavate, they will find evidence of the use of white quartz. It was brought, apparently, to Newgrange from a long distance away. We're told from the Wicklow Mountains, which are 80 kilometres to the south. But other closer alternatives have been suggested. But regardless, we know for a fact that there are stones at Newgrange that came from the Mourne Mountains. And we know that some of the stones came from Clara Head. That's 31 kilometres in each direction. That's a 62 kilometre round trip. For stones like this that weigh anything up to 3, maybe 5 tons apiece, they're not brought in a convoy. They're mm-hmm. being brought one at a time on a big boat, mm-hmm. brought down the river, left at the bank, hauled up the bank perhaps by yoking oxen, mm-hmm. which is suggested in the mythology, by the way. There are references mm-hmm. to oxen being moving large stones, and then back out again to collect the next stone. I mean, when you think about it, it's extraordinary, you know, mm-hmm. what they were able to do with no technology, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this was the only place where people were buried, or is there a settlement nearby?
That's the big question about Bruna Bonia. We don't know where the people lived. We have not found in any of the... There is only very limited excavation has taken place here in modern times. Newgrange, the monument itself, and the immediate area in front of it, Nowth, and the field in which it is located, which is a small field, and a few other little excavations here and there. So we have not yet found the town or the city or wherever these people lived. But there may not necessarily have been a huge settlement here, because the evidence would suggest that actually people came from a long distance to participate in the construction that took place during the Neolithic. And I love the fact that that's hinted at in the Legend of Dowth. Mm-hmm. The men, all the men of Ireland.
Back to the legend of the building with the day which ended abruptly because of the...
solstice and the incest.
Exactly. Does this mean that the monument is incomplete? Not finished?
Actually, that's a really good question, because that... myth in the Dinshanicus, which is the collection of place name, you know, myths about how places were or why they were built or where they get their names from, it actually says that no more will be added to its top from now until doomsday, which suggests that it was incomplete. But we have drawings predating the excavations which show it to be clearly, actually, quite a tall cairn in comparison mm-hmm. to, say, Newgrange, which had a flat top on it. Mm-hmm. And before it was destroyed, or before the damage, there was a tea house on top that had been built by the Viscount Netterville. The Nettervilles were an Anglo-Norman family who had lived mm-hmm. in this area for centuries. And he had a tea house on top of it. So it looked like it was complete, mm-hmm. you know. But I'm interested in that. Because again, at some point during future excavations, it may be revealed that in fact, yeah, we think the monument was incomplete, which would be lovely because that would tie in with the story. But maybe that's wishful. Yeah. Maybe that's wishful thinking on my part. You know, Who knows? Who knows?
Okay, perfect.
And there's the evening star there. There's Venus coming.
Beautiful
down.
Now.
But no Milky Way in these days.
We could see the Milky Way here. Yeah.
Sure.
What is this with the...
I look out this night to make a shoot, but I can't...
You have to get away from the towns and cities into the as far... You know, like Drogheda is a big town, and I it's very hard to see the Milky Way in Drogheda, but I can see it in the wintertime, you know, out here.
But
it's not very clear, though. Mm. I mean, you know...
Mm. Isn't it the white cow?
Yeah. So this is the same Boen, who's the goddess who created the Boyne River... Her name literally means the white cow. And so the river is Aoin Bó Finne, the river of the white cow. Mm-hmm. And the Milky Way in Irish is called Balach na Bó Finne, the way of the white cow.
There's the relation again between cow, goddess, sky, mm-hmm. stars.
Yeah. It's kind of similar to the Venus, where you have the shell connecting heaven and earth. Kind of. So if you have the river, there's the cow.
Well, I think, and I've written this in some of my books, that I think that Venus is the calf. So often in Irish myth, you have, pardon me, a cow and a calf. a magical cow and her calf. And I think that's a reference to the moon and Venus. And it's a curious thing too that before the excavations of Newgrange, there was a folk belief that the morning star shines into the chamber of Newgrange once every 8 years. And it turns out that's actually astronomically quite accurate, because Venus follows an 8-year cycle, you know?
The problem is we are influenced, Felicitas and I, by the Romans because of their myths.
They're high in Germany, and but he said
not only. Yeah. I have slightly problems to understand the Irish mythology.
But he explained that to us before.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You got that.
You got that. And but you because you compared with Venus, and this it's clearly.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the morning star is how it's referred to, but there's a specific reference to Cailleachán na Mórghaoige in Irish, which literally means the early rising little hag.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cailleach, of course, is a very ancient deity, a female deity, associated with the Irish landscape. And I think, and I'm not the only one to think, that Bóin and Cailleach are sort of derivatives, they're related. You know, that you basically get the same idea of a goddess, but she just takes on a slightly different form and name and identity as time moves on. I think it's fascinating that the two chief deities, or two of the supreme deities associated with these great monuments, are one who is very definitely a sun god,
mm-hmm.
and the other who's this river goddess who also seems to have connections to the Milky Way and the cow. The cow, which is absolutely important, vital, because remember, the only reason you can build monuments in the first place is because you have agriculture, you have surplus food. Because before the Neolithic, we're in what we call the Mesolithic, hunter-gatherers. You basically spend all your time finding your food. Now, with agriculture, there are times in the year when you can sit back and relax and go, well, I think we'll do something else today. Let's build a big monument, yeah. you know?
For example, yes.
You know? Yeah. Well, that's what we're told happened. That's what the experts tell us. It makes an amount of sense. And also, the older Neolithic monuments in Ireland are in the west, where the land is poorer. And as you move east, they get bigger and more lavish until you get to the east. This is the best farmland in Ireland. Mm-hmm. In County Meath, in the Boyne Valley. The most productive, the most fertile land in Ireland for agriculture is here. So it makes sense that the biggest monuments would be here. But now I'm arguing with myself, because is it that the monuments were bigger because of the lush agricultural surplus? Or, as we were saying earlier, is it because there was actually a climate problem and nothing was growing that led to the building of them? The two things are contradictory, but they are still possibilities.
I think they built a stone circle on, not Ibiza, where was it?
On one island in the
Yeah, because they had problems with rain not coming there. And then
was the one that was revealed during the drought, was it?
No, they built a new one.
Actually,
a few years ago, and it was like very dry, and then they built that stone monument there, and then it started to rain. And last year they had the biggest amount of rain in whole Spain.
Wow!
So
in the Mediterranean, it's in the Atlantic.
I can find it out for you.
Wow!
I think.
Yeah.
So building a monument can make a difference.
Yeah. At least they
think. Or maybe it's just a coincidence.
Maybe, yeah, but, yeah. Maybe. But yeah. They sent people there to build that and to have that as a reason. So maybe that's also, if you have a big drought and this may be one like, hello, we're here, we need rain. Could be.
Yeah.
A signal.
And because and I was joking with Christopher about it and thought, well, you have so many stone monuments, probably that's why you have Green Island.
Yes. Yeah,
I was just joking.
Liquid sun.
We get a lot of rain in Ireland. Yeah. You know, that's why Ireland is so verdant and so green. you know, some American and, you know, well, foreign visitors come to Ireland and they go, oh, it's so green. How is it so? It's gorgeous, you know. And they come here in the middle of summer and maybe the weather's really nice and they don't have to endure an Irish winter, you know, when it's cold and damp all the time, you know. It's like, that's why it's green, because we get lots of rainfall, you know. Isn't that gorgeous? Look, I mean, you know, we're into, it's 20 to 11. I mean, it won't get dark tonight. It'll get mostly dark, but there'll be a twilight on that horizon. Yeah. And in 2 weeks' time, at midsummer, because myself and Richard Moore, who was my co-author on The Island of the Setting Sun, our first book, well, my first book, our only book together, we came out here at midnight at summer solstice in the early 2000s on a couple of occasions and stayed here for several hours from, say, 11 p.m. through midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and there's constantly enough light to see what you're doing. If you could imagine if you were building at night, you could do so at midsummer in Ireland without the use of artificial light or torches or flames.
Only in 1 year. Then comes winter and then it's getting darker, isn't it?
Oh, only at this specific time of the year.
Yes.
For about 3 weeks, either side of summer solstice. So from the beginning of June until the middle of July, we have this eternal twilight.
But this would mean you have to build a monument in 3 months.
Yep. But remember, it has historically been asked by many archaeologists, were these how long did it take and how many people? And the question was always, I always say it's a very Irish answer, because Irish people have a funny way about them. Well, it either took a small amount of people a long time or a large amount of people a short time, right? Which is a very Irish answer. Well, my belief is that it took a lot of people a short time. We see that, I think, in the late Neolithic landscape. Now, I'm talking about the henges and those timber monuments, that impermanent landscape in front of Newgrange that was packed with monuments, many of them made of timber. And the interesting thing about all the timber monuments that were made of, you know, oak, probably oak, boughs of oak posts, thousands of them, that all, I mean, thousands of oak posts, and maybe at least maybe a dozen monuments, but more than that, probably, they all respect each other's boundaries. None is built on top of another or overlapping another. That has led the archaeologists to suggest they were all standing at the same time. Now, if you're building timber monuments, and you have to dig hundreds of holes, 1.5 to 2 meters deep and 1 meter wide, mm-hmm. with no metal tools, by the way, only stone and bone and wood. Mm-hmm. And those monuments are made of timber, a lot of them, which means they're impermanent. How long does a timber monument last for? Untreated wood? 20 years, maybe? Right? Mm. I think you have your answer. Mm-hmm. I think the Douth myth is accurate in that if you were standing here when it was being built over 5,000 years ago, it may well have seemed that all the men of Ireland had come here to build it.
Yeah.
Because what was the population back then? It can't have been any more than 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, maybe 50,000 at a big stretch. But I think the estimates put it at around 10,000. If you were standing here and you saw several thousand people labouring, you know, to move stone around and everything else, you might just think that. And maybe that's why the story says all the men of Ireland came here to build it, because that's what it looked like.
And maybe because it was really an important thing to do in order to survive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. I think so.
And then if you think about ancestry and, you know, okay, if it's a portal, then maybe also think, okay, if we have connection with our ancestors and they see that we suffer, then they will help too.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just trying to think while you're asking that, are there any examples of that in myth? Not that I can sort of immediately think of. But we do have episodes in myth where, yeah, for instance, Cú Chulainn, that great warrior, where he is single-handedly defending Ulster against the armies of Connacht, Maeve's army. And he's very sort of, he's wounded and he's tired. And his father, who's his supernatural father, who's Lugh Lovefather, Lugh of the Tuatha Dé Danann, Lugh comes to him and says, you relax, take it easy for a few days. I'm going to fend off the armies while you take it easy. So we do have that idea of that, you know, he's reaching out to, well, a supernatural father. Maybe in real life he was an ancestor, you know, asking for help or being offered help, you know.
And one last question. You have a lovely symbol as a necklace.
Yeah.
What is it about? It fits here too.
Well, this is the triple spiral or the triskel, which is owned in megalithic art. It's only found in one monument, and that is Newgrange, Sheedon Broga. It's found on the entrance curbstone, and it's found again in the inside, in the chamber. And this piece is made by a traditional blacksmith called Tom King. He calls himself An Gawa, which is wonderful because An Gawa was the smith god. Mm-hmm. He was the one who made the weapons for the Tuatha Dé Danann. And so Tom works away in the Boyne Valley as a traditional blacksmith, making these jewellery items that are inspired by the megalithic art and the stories of the Boyne Valley, you know. And he's a wonderful character himself. So if your listeners are interested in having a look at those pieces, they're for sale on the Mythical Ireland website.
Mm-hmm. Oh, lovely.
Mythicalireland.com. Lovely. Yeah.
Okay. That's your website too.
Yeah.
And you can also get more information on that website.
Oh, lots.
Yeah.
And on Facebook and Instagram. And my YouTube channel has 1,500 videos and hundreds and hundreds of hours of material. If you're interested in really taking a deep dive into the whole thing, you know, and you've got a lot of time to spare, you know.
And you're also doing tours, especially during summertime, I suppose.
Yes, I've been doing private tours for years, but I'm finding now that if I organise a Mythical Ireland public tour, you know, and the tickets are relatively inexpensive, people are coming. So if you go to the tours page on the website, you'll see which ones are coming up. I've done tours here at Douth and places like Fornox and Loch Crew and the Hill of Tara and Brú na Bóinne. So I'll be doing lots more now this year. So just keep an eye on the website. And if you're in Ireland, when one of the tours is on, book a ticket and come along. I think you'll enjoy it.
We will. Thank you very much for your time and your effort and your flexibility.
Well, I only, you know, I'm 10 minutes away. 10 minutes and I'm home. Which is works in reverse too, that over the years I've been able to come here, you know, like at times like this and get, I'm a photographer as well, and get pictures of the moon or planetary alignments or the Milky Way or whatever.
They're lovely pictures in your books too.
Yeah. And it's lovely to spend time on your own doing that. It's great for the mind. It's as good as meditation. Spend some time here in the evenings, especially after sunset. The twilight hour I always find wonderful, you know.
It's absolutely gorgeous. And it's so peaceful now.
Yeah, you can just about hear the last of the birds. The last bird I usually hear in the Boyne Valley is the blackbird. It's usually the one who sings the latest. And when the blackbird goes quiet, then you'll see the bats start to appear. And it's lovely. It's lovely.
So also where night and day meet in the middle.
Yeah. Which is really what these monuments are all about, I think, isn't it? You know, night and day and this world and the other world. Gods and mortals. Mm. Yeah.
Danke Anthony, danke Fee. Ich hoffe, dass euch dieses Interview gefallen hat. Ich hoffe, das Warten hat sich für euch, für dich gelohnt. Es hat uns gefreut, dass du mit dabei warst. Wenn du noch mehr wissen willst, noch mehr hören willst, dann schau doch auch mal auf Facebook in unserer Gruppe vorbei, passend zu unserem Podcast Erlebnis Irland. Ich verlinke es in den Shownotes. Ansonsten wünsche ich dir einen ganz, ganz tollen Tag. Bis bald. Dein Chris und
deine Fee.